You are tuned in to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. I am Mira Soleiros, hosting the show like every Thursday from 2 until 3 p.m. We have on the phone now David Barbara, who is the press officer for the Animal Liberation Front. Are you with us, David?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the show again.
Thank you for having me.
There was a campaign of harassment directed against you, David Barbara, and also against Darren Thurston that had been going on for 5 years and in which the RCMP was involved. As part of that, there were charges that I think were laid against you, I think in 1997, in relation to some booby trap letters that were sent to some guide outfitters, and all of that came to an end last week, I think, when the charges were stayed. So we're going to go through all of that. Maybe you could give us some information as to how all of this campaign of harassment started in the first year, 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's quite a long and complex story, but I'll try to give it a nutshell version for you. Basically, myself and Darren Thurston were convicted of liberating 29 cats from the University of Alberta in Edmonton. This was an action that we did in 1992, and we both served some jail time for that action. And because of our involvement and association, we became the prime suspects in this investigation. The investigation started in July of 1995 after four mail bombs were sent to various right-wing targets and a geneticist that summer. And the RCMP basically focused on us because we were active and outspoken. We also are involved with anti-fascist and anti-racist work. So they said, well, basically, you know, we don't really have any suspects, we don't have any evidence, but, you know, who are we going to look at? So they chose us and proceeded to pour a massive amount of resources, money, and energy into targeting and harassing us. And this was back in July of 95 when they basically instigated incredible amount of surveillance, physical surveillance on us, using their own teams and coordinated law enforcement units out here in Vancouver and such. Now, several months after that, and while we were under surveillance, the crimes for which we were charged with, those actions took place in January of 1996, and those were these razor blade letters sent to guide outfitters and hunters in BC and Alberta. And you have to remember, we were under surveillance at the time that these letters were sent out. We were also suspected of sending out letters to furriers, similar razor blade letters to furriers in March of 96. And just trying to think of how to put this all in perspective. A year after these actions took place, in March of 97, we discovered several listening devices in vehicles and homes, and we dismantled those listening devices. And shortly after that, the RCMP raided our homes, ostensibly to, basically, they, you know, it was like, well, they caught our listening devices. We have to move now to preserve any so-called evidence because the gig is up. You know, they know that they're being watched. We knew we were being watched for quite a long time, actually. So in March of 97, they raided five locations related to our homes and our friends' homes, and they carted away a massive amount of information, paperwork, computers, computer files, books, clothing, tapes, videos, toys, you know, innocuous stuff that they thought had some connection. Basically, it was a fishing expedition. A year after the raids, no charges had been laid. The way the system works is that if the RCMP or the police raid you, they have to lay charges within a year, or else they have to give all the stuff back. Or if they want to keep the stuff that they've seized, they have to go to a higher court. So knowing that they'd likely not be able to get any authorization to keep any of the stuff they got from our residences, a year to the day after they raided, they laid these charges of sending razor blade letters. And that was in March of 98. And we'd been out on bail ever since that time. And bail conditions included not leaving the province of BC, surrendering our passports, reporting once a week to the RCMP, not having any contact with each other, things like that. So for the next 2.5 years, we were living with these bail conditions and with this threat of prosecution over our heads, until finally, 2.5 years later, they decide to stay the charges.
What does it mean when they say they stay the charges?
Basically, it means that they give up. They don't have any evidence to ensure convictions. They don't believe that they can continue with the process and win. The stay of charges means that if any new evidence comes to light within a year, they can reinstate the charges. Mm-hmm. But that's very rare and unlikely to happen. So the matter is effectively closed. In fact, the RCMP have stated to the media that the file is closed.
It's like they're putting the charges on the back burner.
Yeah, but really, it's
but there's no electricity
altogether.
Going in the burner anymore.
Yeah. Now, the reason they stayed the charges, I believe, is very interesting, because once we were actually charged with these crimes, we initiated various proceedings through the courts to obtain full and complete disclosure from the Crown to say, you know, what evidence do you have? I mean, there has never been any evidence that we had mailed anything in the mail, be it bombs or letters, or razor blade letters. There was a massive amount of surveillance on us. There was a massive amount of intercepted communications on us. But despite all of this, there was no evidence connecting us to these crimes. Mm-hmm. So we initiated a process to recover full disclosure from the RCMP and the Crown over the course of the 2.5 years. And when we finally reached the BC Supreme Court level and received our trial judge, that was when we started having the real disclosure hearings take place. And through those disclosure hearings, we had some very important information ordered release to us, and in that information we had confirmation of an undercover operation that was used against us by the RCMP. And this undercover operation involved infiltrating a local left-wing coffee house, involved trying to set myself and Darren up to commit an arson under the guise of fighting the bear parts trade, where they brought us out to a remote location in the Lower Mainland here in British Columbia and brandished a gasoline can and encouraged us to set fire to a building. We, of course, refused and were shocked and, you know, we're like, you know, where are you coming from? Who are you people? And we left and we didn't hear from these undercover operatives any longer since then. We had confirmation that this undercover operation existed through the RCMP disclosure. And this is important because throughout these proceedings, including at our preliminary hearing, where the lead investigator took the stand and said under oath that no undercover operation existed or was used against us, and this was repeated a number of times in various ways and was echoed by the senior Crown prosecutor who was trying the case. Now, after that preliminary hearing, we received this disclosure confirming this operation did exist, which included the names of the RCMP officers involved. We had the name of one of the officers involved prior to this disclosure because comparing handwriting and other samples of evidence from the time that she worked at La Cana as an infiltrator and the time that she worked as an RCMP investigating us. On July 13th of this year, we had another disclosure hearing, and we had the judge ordered certain information disclosed to us once again, and included in that information was a paragraph that came from the affidavits for warrant and officer's notes that was in relation to March 27th, 1996. Now, and this date is very significant because on this date is the day that three of these RCMPs brought us out to this remote location, Fort Langley, and tried to set us up to commit an arson. And we had this paragraph from that day order disclosed to us on July 13th. And this is really the crux of the issue. This is why the RCMP and the Crown stayed the charges. They didn't want to release to us that information that was contained in that paragraph. It would say, one, that for sure there was an RCMP undercover operation used against us, and two, it would prove that their lead investigator actually lied in court under oath when they said that that kind of operation did not exist. So we never did receive that disclosure. 2 months later, we had the charges stayed against us instead.
A lot of people listening, I'm sure, when they hear about infiltrators, when they hear about, I think even some grassroots activists who, you know, are not familiar with being directly targeted and harassed by the government or the police, when they hear about infiltrators, undercover RCMP officers and all that stuff, it seems to them maybe like science fiction. So I'm wondering, for you and Darren, during these years, is there a point at which, because you know that you're the target of these people and of the government, of their RCMP, is there some point at which you just suspect anybody around you to be like somebody who's spying on you and trying to gather information or set you up to say something that could be interpreted as something else in court? Or do you get paranoid eventually, or do you remain calm throughout this whole thing?
It's very interesting because there are various different levels of surveillance and infiltration. We have these four or five officers who were involved in infiltrating, and by that I mean they were pretending to be people who they weren't. And then we have numerous officers and RCMPs and CSIS and others who are involved in surveillance, and that's different from infiltrating. They're just surveying us. You know, as far as the actual infiltrators go, I mean, right from the start, when these people first arrived on the scene, it was obvious to myself and those who had contact with them that something was not right with these people. They weren't who they said they were. And there's, you know, a lot of different signs that you can watch for to see. I mean, you know, spreading money around easily, although having no obvious means of income, you know, operating cell phones frequently. I mean, a lot of these actions can seem innocent and are in certain situations, but when you piece them together with everything else that you know about these people, then a certain picture comes to light. We didn't know who they were from the beginning. We thought they could have been RCMP, they could have been local Vancouver cops, they could have been CSIS, or they could have been actually industry trying to set us up. The surveillance teams, it's very funny because we were very paranoid and we had a reason to be. The surveillance teams included up to 8 or 10 RCMP officers tailing us at any given time. And this would be on in vehicles, on foot, in buses, on bikes, and behind you in the lineup at the bank, at the table beside you at the cafe. And, of course, they would have an operator sitting in a van who was monitoring the room bugs and the phone bugs and advising the ground surveillance crew what our actions were and where we were going. And
so you could actually see a van outside of your place or following you around?
Well, no. We know that there was a van that was stationed in a church parking lot not too far from one of our homes, and we know this because of the disclosure that we received. The surveillance notes refer to their surveillance operations and how they set it up and how they actually operated it. But, you know, it's funny because there were times when we'd said, everyone around us is a cop, you know, everyone's following us. And we would say it half jokingly and half seriously. And, you know, the strange thing is, in some of the disclosure we recently received, the RCMP were complaining to CSIS to back off on surveillance of us because there was all these CSIS agents following us and all these RCMP agents following us, and the RCMP were getting concerned that there were so many people on us that we were beginning to notice them and actually playing around with them, or so they thought. Kind of sick in a, you know, humorous in a sick and twisted kind of way, but that's what happened to us.
In activist circles, people get close to each other. People enter in relationships, sometimes in loving relationships, sexual relationships,
yeah,
in friendships. What happens in your experience, because you have a long experience, you know, dealing with being targeted, being surveilled, and also being infiltrated in some way. So what has been your experiences with undercover officers like this? Do they actually become personally involved with you? Will they share information about their girlfriends, boyfriends, what they do in bed and all that kind of thing to actually try to make you believe that they're real people?
That does occur, although it didn't really occur in our situation, though the way this undercover operation began was quite insidious. We had a close personal friend of ours who was an activist who died tragically in a hiking accident in the fall of or winter of 1995. When this undercover operation first began. And the first contact we had with these undercovers was one of them who came up to me and said after Corey's death, oh, you know, Corey spoke, you know, at great lengths about you and all of the great things you've done, you know, can we go out for a coffee at some time and talk about some of this stuff? I've got some great ideas, you know, I think he'd be interested in. That was pretty much the extent to which they tried to get involved in our personal life. The rest of their involvement centered around our political work, dealing with animal abuse issues. But you're right, in other situations, they have formed personal relationships with their targets to extract information and set them up.
How pervasive is this kind of behavior from the RCMP and other agencies, you think, around activist circles? Is it something that's particular and specific? And I'm talking about in the context of Canada. Is it something that's specific to you and Darren or to animal rights activists? Or it's something that you think a lot of grassroots activists in diverse social justice movements experience?
Well, I think it's pervasive throughout the entire spectrum of social justice movements and environmental and animal rights movements in Canada. Some of the same officers who were involved in the undercover operation against us were also involved in the undercover operation against protesters or activists who were protesting the APEC conference in Vancouver in, I guess it was 97 or 98, I can't remember now. No, this is a tactic that the RCMP use regularly and frequently to gain so-called intelligence on the movements that they're trying to destroy. And we have to remember here, these undercover operations aren't motivated by criminal actions or law and order. They're purely political operations that are meant to disrupt and destroy legitimate, nonviolent political resistance movements in Canada. And especially when we see that CSIS is involved, and we know for certain the information that CSIS was surveying us. You know, CSIS is an intelligence gathering agency. As far as I'm aware, they're not supposed to be targeting political activists within Canada, but yet they did so quite regularly and frequently with us. These are politically motivated campaigns of harassment and nothing less.
So what are your feelings now about the charges against you and Darren having been stayed? Are you satisfied with that? Are you relieved? Are you happy, cheering? How do you feel about it?
Yeah, it's very mixed feelings I have about it. I'm trying now to piece together my life and remember where I was before I was raided in March of 97, and you know, I'm not there now, but I'm trying to like refocus and carry on my life post charges, and somewhat relieved that this kind of harassment or the overt kind of harassment is no longer hanging over my head. I don't have to report to the RCMP once a week. I hopefully will get my passport back soon, and I'm free to travel and move around as I did before. So it's a great relief to have the charges dropped. But on the other hand, the charges being stayed is a technical, procedural type of move that leaves questions hanging. I did not get my day in court, so to speak. You know, I fully expected to go to trial. Our trial was scheduled for January, by the way. And I was fully expecting an acquittal. I mean, there's no evidence against me on these charges. And I wasn't looking forward to spending 5 weeks or more in court, but I was looking forward to the end result, which would have been complete acquittal and exoneration. You know, a determination without a doubt that I was not involved and I'm not guilty of these crimes. So having the charges stayed or dropped denied me that result, that finality of this episode of my life. And I'm actually kind of upset about that. I would have much preferred to go into trial and get an acquittal than have the charges dropped or stayed. But, you know, I'll take it. You know, I don't have a choice. And I'm glad the charges have been dropped. But it's kind of a bittersweet kind of thing going on.
How do you feel? And because you continue to be the press officer for the Animal Liberation Front. And as such, you are somebody whom the authorities can and want to target. So how do you feel about the future now? Do you think that this these charges being stayed is just one step in a long process in which the authorities will keep on trying to gather information about you, try to to set you up, try to harass you and try to break you down in some ways? Or do you think that they simply think like, oh no, they're too complicated to get, let's just let them keep on talk about what the ALF actions and everything, but it's too much for us and it's not that much efficient to go after him?
I think that I will always be, probably both Darren and I will always be targets or prime suspects in any action. During the course of the investigation against us, we've both been named in documents as being the prime suspects in almost every animal rights or environmental action that has occurred in British Columbia in the last 5 years, and this includes several mink releases, several turkey poisoning hoaxes at supermarkets, several arsons of hunting outfit places in 95, and some obscure organization called the David Organization. Because my name is David, I was a prime suspect in that. I don't think for a minute they're going to stop monitoring my moves. I mean, all my phones will still be monitored. Perhaps there will be some physical surveillance on me, but I will always be monitored, and I'm sure they'll always collect information and try to continue to lay charges. I mean, just recently in Iowa, in the U.S., there was one of the most major mink released out of a fur farm in Iowa several weeks ago, and the sheriffs down there want to consider laying charges against me for being the press officer for aiding and abetting or something by promoting the liberation. And I'm sure they were in touch with the RCMP officers up here, and they were trying to figure out ways to charge me and extradite me to the U.S. to face charges there. So I don't doubt that I will always be a target, and that's just the way it is when you want to fight for animal rights.
Now, if people want to access your website, do you know it by heart, the ALF website? Is it maintained by the same group, or how does this all work together?
The Frontline Information Service is a separate organization from the ALF and the ALF Press Office, and you can access it easily. It's www.animalliberation.net. And there you can find information on not only ALF, but other animal liberation groups as well. And there's a wealth of information there.
And if you subscribe to the listserv, I think that's how it's called, the listserv, then you can, like us on Animal Voices, be kept always up to date with the latest information that from the Animal Liberation Front, and be up to date with all your information. Thanks a lot for being with us, David.
Well, thank you for having me.
And good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.